Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 91, Lakota Lessons from the Bow and Arrow, from a book by Joseph M. Marshall III. Joseph Marshall was born and grew up on the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Because he was raised in a traditional native household by his maternal grandparents, his first language is Lakota. In that environment, he also learned the ancient tradition of oral storytelling. He is a specialist in wilderness survival and a practitioner of primitive Lakota archery, having learned from his grandfather the art of handcrafting bows and arrows. Joseph writes full-time and has published 9 nonfiction works, 3 novels, a collection of short stories and essays, a children's book, and several screenplays. He has also appeared in several television documentaries, served as technical advisor for movies, and had a role in a major TV network movie, Return to Lonesome Dove. In 2005, he was a technical advisor and narrator for the 6-part miniseries Into the West, in which he also acted the role of Loved by the Buffalo. This is from about the author in the book, The Lakota Way of Strength and Courage, Lessons in Resilience from the Bow and Arrow. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Joseph M. Marshall III has a whole bunch of books. I read The Journey of Crazy Horse, A Lakota History, which is fabulous biography of Crazy Horse, a.k.a. He Whose Horse is Enchanted. He's got another book, which I've heard bits of, Keep Going, The Art of Perseverance. And this one, The Lakota Way of Strength and Courage, Lessons in Resilience from the Bow and Arrow. It's a wonderful blend of native storytelling, some of the history, and also some of the key history at the transition times from the Lakota going from being plains natives to, you know, being subjects of the U.S. Empire, so to speak, in the as far as cultural assimilation process. And so it's got native stories, also personal, real-life stories with his various teachers, relatives. I think mostly a strong influence from his elders, his grandparents. Maybe that'll be mentioned in some of the quotes I read. So he got a deep respect for the elders early on. And just a wonderful person. Seen some clips from him on YouTube, and there's actually an interview with him from one of the publishers of Sounds True, soundstrue.com, a very innovative and open-minded publisher out of Boulder, Colorado. So let's see, we'll start with the little bit of the introduction. Child of the Moon, Child of the Sun. There was a time when Lakota boys looked at a new bow and arrows the way any modern teenager gazes at an iPod, a cell phone, or the latest version of a video game, longingly and lovingly. There was one basic difference, however. Lakota boys eventually learned how to make their own bows and arrows and learned the life lessons associated with them. Bows and arrows have been around for thousands of years, and as weapons for hunting and warfare were critical to the survival of cultures all over the world, they were frequently and literally the difference between starvation and plenty, and very often between life and death. Although I heard about the bow, Itazipa, don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, and the arrow, Wa'inkpe, in stories told by both of my maternal grandparents, I never actually saw the real thing until my grandfather made a set in 1950. The bow was of ash wood and the arrows were thin choke cherry stalks. Like countless Lakota boys before me, I was immediately drawn to them. The feeling was somewhat like meeting an old friend. More than likely, I felt an inherent cultural connection with them. My lifelong fascination began the moment my grandfather placed the arrows one at a time on the bowstring and shot them in the air. As I watched these feathered shafts arc gracefully through the sky, I knew they would be part of my life for as long as I lived. When I asked where the bow came from, it was my grandmother who replied, "From the moon," she said. She explained that the moon was a woman and it was she who gave us Lakota the bow. I accepted what she said without question. Several evenings later, she showed me the sliver of a new moon hanging in the sky. The thin silver crescent looked exactly like my grandfather's bow when he drew it back to shoot an arrow. According to my grandfather, someone in the distant past saw that same sliver of a new moon and related it to the function of a bow. A bow works by reacting to being drawn or bent when the archer pulls back on the string. When the string is released, the reflexive action launches the arrow. Anyone who's familiar with how a bow works, and especially anyone who has constructive primitive bows, knows that the bow must be designed to withstand the stress of being drawn or bent. Bad design or poor craftsmanship will cause one or both of the limbs to work improperly or even break under the stress. If nothing else, a primitive Lakota bow is the epitome of simplicity. And I think it goes on to say I already knew. Sooner or later, I asked the next obvious question. If the bow came from the moon, where did the arrow come from? From the sun, was my grandfather's reply. I already knew that the sun was considered a man, so I deduced correctly, as it turned out, that the arrow must be male. One late afternoon, when the sun's rays were shafts of light descending through a broken bank of clouds, my grandfather pointed to them. Those were the arrows of the sun. While the bow was a graceful curve, the arrow was absolutely as straight could be. So it goes on. There's a bit of technical detail about the actual making of the bows and arrows, the woods, the usage, the hunting. And it's also interesting that his connection to the bow and arrow, even though it, for the most part, is not used nowadays for hunting and survival, along the lines of the Genocide of the Mind anthology series, which still has a section or so to go, they've been describing how the keeping the songs and the stories alive from people of the past. And so here again, we see this tradition passed down and continued. And even though the actual usage may be changed, actually a song about, going down the rivers may not be the literal thing now, but it could be weaving one's way through the highway. But the principle remains the same and still of use. So in this book, it's presented, there's a little bit of, I don't want to label it, but it's sort of, you might call it self-help, not really self-help, but all my relations help, maybe. But it's a good bit of learning that comes through it that you can find beneficial, because those are popular books along with learning some other stuff. But the five selected lessons are transformation, simplicity, purpose, strength, and resiliency. And he writes, "These five are not all there is to life, but they are the lessons from the bow and arrow that are most consistent for me. Of the five, one is a process, transformation, and the others are characteristics. All can be related directly to the art of making primitive bows and arrows and to most things in life." And the first section is transformation. Each section starts with a little story. And in this part, "Children were taught early that everything and everyone has a place and a purpose. Elders were revered as the source of knowledge and wisdom. Everyone treated elders with courtesy and respect." So most of the sections start off with a story. Then it goes into some of the history or personal history. This section, "The Conversations of Old Men. In the 1950s, I once heard several old Lakota men on the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation talking about the past. Their generation often did, since their grandparents, born in the 1860s, were the last to live the nomadic life that preceded the U.S. government's establishment of the reservation in 1881. Such conversations frequently compared the present to the past. Understandably, there was always a certain amount of nostalgia and regret." So, you know, here's that example of he's got conversation and information passed down through his elders about what that key transition phase was like in the 1860s and 80s. And there's even some discussion of an Episcopal church, which is on the reservation. So that's interesting, too. And here's another bit. "One of those old men said that the changes that had happened to the Lakota people between the 1850s and the 1950s were like a circle of light cast by the flames of a torch or the beam of a flashlight moving in the darkness. All the old men, my maternal grandfather among them, agreed with the analogy. They agreed that because of 2 to 3 generations of difficult changes, cultural memory was hanging on to the trailing edge of that circle of light. Once that light moved on, many things would be left in the darkness." One of those old men took that analogy a step further, a viewpoint that I have never forgotten. He used the stone arrowhead as a prime example of how change can and does transform us and things, beliefs, and institutions attendant to being who we are. Projectile points, including arrow points, have been part of the human arsenal of weaponry for tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years. For the Lakota, the craft of making stone arrowheads came to a sudden end around 1840 after cast iron became consistently available to them and other indigenous peoples. Almost immediately came the realization that iron could be used in the crafting of traditional Lakota weapons, more precisely the lance point and arrowhead. So we're talking about cultural memory and how, you know, certain things are hanging on and how important it is to pass those things down and how precious certain conversations with people can be. 1868, many Lakota leaders agreed to the terms of the treaty negotiated at Fort Laramie, what is now southeastern Wyoming. Yeah, so you know, some of this is the history you can read up on. In 1889, the U.S. Congress passed the Sioux Act, which created 6 distinct reservations. The Hunkpapa occupied the Standing Rock Reservation in the north central position of what would become the state of South Dakota. Adjacent and to the south were the, I don't know how to pronounce these, several other names, bands on the Cheyenne River Reservation. The Secaugu were given the Rosebud Sioux Reservation to the south central portion of the later to be state, and the Oglala moved into the southwest area onto the Pine Ridge Reservation. A splinter group from the Secaugu Rosebud became the inhabitants of the Lower Brule Reservation, by far the smallest reservation along the Missouri. By 1890, the circumstances for all Native people in the West could be summed up in one word: overwhelmed. They had been overwhelmed by a nation with more technology than they had and with a sense of racial superiority that fostered an attitude of entitlement. Mostly, however, it was an issue of numbers. So I was talking about this section of transformation and how the people were transformed, you know, by this whole experience. You know, how we go through personal transformations and then cultural transformations. "Those who cause such transformation have self-serving reasons for doing so. Europeans and Euro-Americans wanting to, quote, civilize North and South American natives tried and are still trying to transform us into versions of themselves so they can feel more comfortable." You can see some other stats. The U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs was established in 1842. Now, here's an interesting distinction. He makes a distinction between assimilation and acculturation. In the late 1800s, the U.S. government launched an intensive policy of assimilation. The word assimilate means to take in and incorporate at one's own, absorb, to bring into conformity with the customs and attitudes of a dominant cultural group. In 1924, the U.S. Congress granted American citizenship to Native people. Then in 1934, Congress passed the Indian Reorganization Act. Now, whereas acculturation he describes as having more of a choice. Acculturation is the process of adopting by choice the cultural traits or social patterns of another group. The reason some Native Americans still have a strong connection to who and what we have been is that we chose the path of acculturation. We chose to affect what we were becoming, no matter what the proponents of assimilation were trying to do. Making this choice is a large reason we have arrived in the 21st century with most of our sense of cultural identity intact. Neither acculturation nor assimilation is easy or harmless, but choosing to transform is far more beneficial than being forced to, because it allows us to select the qualities of another group that appeal to and are useful to us. Those who endured and clung to their Lakota ways and identity did so because they found a way to adapt. They outwardly lived the way the U.S. government and the missionaries wanted them to, but inwardly they hung on to the language, beliefs, customs, and traditions that made them Lakota. They turned assimilation into acculturation and taught their children to do the same. And another stat, according to BIA statistics, 60% of Native Americans live off reservations and 40% live on reservations. And he talks about the educational system too, the forced educational system, and says how eventually that's become an avenue for Native American positive advancement. And he says the significance of this ongoing phenomenon is that Native people changed into a useful tool the very instrument that had been used to destroy Native culture. That's an interesting angle on transformation. Indian education, like law, was different before Europeans came. Native societies employed effective approaches for teaching children and young people to be self-sufficient, caring, and productive members of society. By and large, education was usually a one-on-one process of instruction and mentoring. Girls and young women were taught by their mothers, grandmothers, and aunts. Boys were taught by their fathers, uncles, and grandfathers. And, you know, it's fostering, he says, foster self-confidence and a sense of place in the village, community, and society. So different from the sense of alienation that a lot of the modern culture has. Second section is simplicity. He has the main story at the beginning is about a scout. And the people wonder how he became to be such a good scout. And that, he says, attributes to his grandmother. My grandmother taught me much in those 5 days. This is the scout talking. Grandmother taught me much in those 5 days, the Lance said. All she carried across the river was her knife, an empty bag for berries, and a small bundle of dried meat. That was what I could see. What I could not see was how she approached life. Her way was simple and straightforward. That philosophy, combined with her considerable knowledge, made her a very powerful person. The young man was thoughtful for a moment. Does that mean, Grandfather, he asked quietly, that the more you know in your mind, the less you can carry in your hand? The Lance smiled. Yes, and the less you carry in your hand, the faster you can move and the better you can hide and blend into everything around you. That is how I was able to be a good scout. So this is the chapter on simplicity. Simplicity. Overall, the primitive pre-reservation culture of the Lakota made good use of the simple approach. Simplicity was the root of every method or philosophy. This is not to say that life cannot become complicated, because it often did, but the simplest way to achieve an objective or solve a problem was always preferred. That was one of my dad's quotes, life is simple, but people make it complicated. And then he's got an interesting list of what simplicity means to him today. This is Marshall personally writing, and a lot of it has to do with the gadgetry. He says, I will never forget that the pencil predates the word processor and printer, nor will I forget that the storyteller came before the book, that the spoken word is much older than the written word. Silence is the path that leads to knowing myself or getting reacquainted with myself. Advanced age is a consequence of chronology. Any wisdom that may come with old age must be earned. Wisdom that I have earned does not belong to me. It is available as a gift to anyone younger who truly seeks it. While I do text and email, I can let people know that I prefer to have a conversation without having to record a message or listen to one. And what I prefer most is talk face-to-face in person without Skype. But, you know, he does say that even with the technology, if, you know, elders and talking with children, it's a connection. If it's heartfelt, hey, it's making good use of the technology, again, to carry on those principles and traditions. And he has some very, very profound stuff in here, too. I will approach each day knowing that those who have gone before me are watching and those who come after me will reap what I do with that day. I will not let the good or the bad of the past own me, but I will let it teach me. I will never forget those who have helped me along the way, and I will endeavor to forgive those who tried to hinder me. I will never forget where I came from. I will never forget that I have an obligation to give happiness, and that giving happiness is the way to receive it. I will never forget that I came into the world with nothing. Living this moment and this day is well within my ability. All of the foregoing can be attempted and accomplished and realized and learned and remembered without a gadget or an instrument of any kind. And third section, purpose. Very few objects in the world symbolize function and purpose like a primitive bow and arrow. In fact, long ago they were used in marriage ceremonies to teach just those things. A wise, respected old man would be asked to speak to the bride and groom and to the gathering at large. He stood before everyone with a bow and arrow in his hands and talked. His words were not a lecture, but advice for the young couple and a reminder for the husbands and wives in the village. He began by telling everyone that the bow was female because it was a gift of the moon, who was a woman. The arrow was male because it came from the sun, who was a man. The function of the bow was to send off the arrow, and the function of the arrow was to fly. And he's talking about finding his purpose of being a storyteller. My grandparents and other elders in the community told me often and gently to remember the stories. None of them ever told me that I had to be a storyteller. I came to my own decision as a young adult after a persistent but hazy question finally came clear to me one day. Who will pass on the stories? I decided that I could do that, not for any grandiose reasons, ulterior motives, or recognitions. I decided to pass on the stories because someone had to. That is not to say that I am the only Lakota passing on Lakota stories, because I am not. It is critical that the core of our Lakota culture be preserved by any Lakota who has the knowledge, not primarily so that the world can receive it, but so that the information is available to the next Lakota generation. And he talks about the elders, and you know, I think his respect reminds me of, I think about, you know, just in general as a kid, every place, you know, whether it's going to the park, going to school, going to summer camp, whatever it was, some elder, some relative drove me, walked with me, fed me, etc., etc. So, yeah, it just feels like that's important to give a sort of eternal thanks for that, all of that that helps feed us and make us who we are today, sort of like the roots of the tree. And towards the end of this section, because when all is said and done, a sense of purpose is more powerful than money. That is the reality of the real world beyond the marquee lights and box scores. Crazy Horse accepted the shirt. They have a sort of sacred shirt that was awarded to certain natives because he felt it was his purpose, whether he wanted the responsibility that came with it or not. Once he took the shirt, he endeavored to live his life the best way he knew how, as example for others. In fulfilling his purpose, he achieved his destiny, being of selfless service to others. He knew he was not to seek reward and recognition for anything he did on behalf of others, and he never did. Even without reward or recognition, he had a sense of fulfillment. And strength. Yeah, it's a very interesting story. He calls the church people the Black Robes. That's actually an interesting movie I just watched online about the Jesuit priest that comes over and is meeting with the Algonquins, called Black Robe. It's got about maybe 10 minutes of violent stuff I forwarded through. But overall, it's an interesting snippet of history in the 1600s. But in this story, he refers to the Black Robes. He had a pipe that was, he had to hide it from the Black Robes, and the story is about how he passed it down to his son, I think, and just sort of outsmarting the system It's a great story. And he talks about strength. Facing up to a problem and taking action does not guarantee success. Thomas Edison engaged in hundreds of failed attempts to make a light bulb before he succeeded. But when he talked about his failures, he said he had simply found hundreds of ways not to make a light bulb. As Edison indicates, facing a tough situation is, in and of itself, perhaps the most important part of the process. Once we have done so, no matter the outcome, we have learned not to quit, and knowing that we should not give up is powerful knowledge to have. Adversity does come into our lives in many forms, be they problems, obstacles, or challenges that each of us contend with over the course of our personal or professional lives. We have probably learned that there are two basic ways to deal with things: hope they will eventually go away, or face them. However we choose to deal with such things, we should know and understand that they are opportunities to gain emotional and mental toughness. And he gives interesting, you know, examples in all of these about certain relatives and people who embodied the qualities of the book, you know, of the what he's highlighting again. Some transformation, simplicity, purpose, strength, and resiliency. And that just, you know, the thing, it can be subtle too. The life lessons that create strength. It's another thing he mentions. Interestingly, too, because, you know, so often hear about the Native Indigenous peoples in a non-hierarchical, egalitarian way, but, you know, there is some sense of structure, and he talks about the hierarchy of leadership was simple from top to bottom. A gathering of old men or village council, then the medicine men, and civilian leaders and military leaders, warriors and warrior societies, the people or general population. How that all, you know, integrated, I'm not sure. Obviously far more egalitarian than the current, you know, Western and other government systems. Interesting bit here. Except for certain instances such as the village breaking camp and moving, this system functioned without authority that could be enforced. In fact, the word authority did not exist in the pre-reservation. The old men themselves would talk about an issue or problem at length, sometimes for days on end. When they had come to a conclusion, they announced it to the people in the form of advice, not as a directive or an order. But given that any gathering of elders collectively represented hundreds of years of experience and was an astounding repository of combined knowledge, the people listened carefully and more often than not did what the old men advised. And then he's talking about more of the politics of the U.S. and the territories. It may be somewhat accurate to say or assume that the various bands had no form of government, traditional or otherwise, but there was no lack of leadership. Men like Spotted Tail and Sitting Bull and others were still regarded as leaders by their people, but the cohesive and powerful influence of pre-reservation village councils was essentially gone. So this, you know, this sounds like the why I'm sort of a, would say I'm in favor of conscious anarchism, sort of a free flowing, but there's a built-in sense of reality there. Then he highlights the strength of the women. If not for two groups, Lakota culture probably would not have survived the period between 1870 and 1940. Those two groups were the women and elders. Women simply kept doing what they had done for countless generations, being nurturers and the backbones of families. To put it bluntly, they kept their families together even as their husbands and sons were floundering, trying to find a place and a purpose in the new life under white authority. It was during this time that alcoholism gained a foothold, adding another burden for families to deal with. The elders, meanwhile, were also a source of strength. They reminded everyone that the best way to endure and survive the new order was for Lakota people to remember who they were, that living like the white people did not mean being like the white people. The circumstances required the Lakota to be strong. No one can convince me otherwise. Were it not for women and elders rising to the challenge when their people were the most vulnerable, Lakota culture might have been a total loss. Assimilation might have won. There were losses, however, and perhaps one of the most profound is the loss of our Lakota regard for elders. There has been a disconnect in that regard, primarily because we have bought into the mainstream society's attitude towards elders. Now it is not unusual for us, like most people, to relegate our elders to nursing homes, which is a far cry from the revered place the elderly traditionally had in the Lakota family and community. In the nomadic era, the lodges of the elderly were not pitched in the, quote, elder section. There was no such place. Old people usually lived next door to their children. Widows and widowers often lived with their children, making a three-generation household. Interesting enough, nursing homes or rest homes or assisted living facilities are a relatively recent phenomenon. Generally speaking, that approach to elder care began in the 19th century with church groups establishing special homes for elderly people, usually for a particular ethnic or religious background. So again, a lot of interesting historical tidbits. Interesting thing here, recent statistics indicate that 20% of the American population is 14 years and under, 67% is between the ages of 15 and 64, and nearly 13% is 65 or older. In approximate numbers, the last category comprises 39 million people. Those 39 people have a combined 2,535,000,000 years of life experience. There is no greater treasure or resource. That's the kind of statistic you don't hear too often. And the last section, resiliency, which I guess perhaps here's one of the best metaphors he gives. A bow is drawn many, many times to send its arrows, he said. This is part of the story. And each time it returns to what it was, ready to send the next arrow. No matter what happened to that blind old woman, she was always the same as she was before, a strong and quiet woman. That's he's talking about Grandma Redleaf's life. She had a lot of losses of her family, but that's the image of resiliency. She just kept on going. I'll read that again. A bow is drawn many, many times to send its arrows, and each time it returns to what it was, ready to send the next arrow. That reminds me of the Zen mind, beginner's mind, and to say that the period between 1890 and 1940 was strange and stressful for the Lakota people as they tried to adjust to a restricted and controlled lifestyle on the reservation would be the understatement of a lifetime. My grandparents and great-grandparents were in the thick of it, and the fact that their generations emerged with their individual sense of identity intact, as well as retaining their culture, is nothing short of a miracle. They were able to do it individually and collectively because they were tough and resilient. As I have said elsewhere in this book, my great-grandparents' generation was completing the hard turn, so to speak, that their parents had started, that is, from the nomadic life of the prairies to the sedentary life of the reservation. They were expected to give up one culture and assimilate to another, as if they were taking off an old pair of shoes and putting on new ones. And then it goes on, with the quiet, steadfast, and unhurried manner, as I have described before, both of them, talking about several relatives now, both of them faced their share of hardship and difficulty, yet for me, the persistent and quiet manner in which they did beadwork is among the enduring memories I have of each of them. Each of them produced beautiful work, and many pieces are now family heirlooms, so is their persistence. With the quiet, steadfast, and unhurried manner with which they approached their tasks, they showed me how I should live my life. They showed me how to be resilient. All of my grandparents epitomized the best qualities and characteristics of being human, among them resiliency. They faced the worst that life threw at them with the best of what they were. Just as important, they demonstrated one significant reality about resiliency. It is a quiet, persistent process. And then the book ends with a story about the stone carriers, these two guys that go out on a journey, guided by a vision to find some stones. It sounds similar to the Euro-Western alchemy of the Philosopher's Stone. And he ends up, the last section, sort of a pun, parting shots, with thinking of the bow and arrow. Try as I might, I can find nothing meaningful beyond their obvious uses in any of the gimmicks and gadgets at my beck and call. Computers, cell phones, and printers do not inspire me to think of my life and the kind of person I might be. Perhaps because it is I grew up in a time when technology was not an in-your-face part of life and was not regarded as a symbol of human achievement or superiority, at least among the people who matter to me. Decades ago, technology was not a god. Using it was still somewhat of a choice. I knew of several families, mostly Indian and some white, in the late 1940s and early 50s who were leery of electricity. Like the telephone, it was one of the new things in our part of the world, especially for Indians. Without exactly knowing how it was produced artificially, Indians already had a word for electricity because they knew what it was. The word was wakangli, which means lightning. What fascinated and even awed many Indians was that white people had found a way to make lightning. They had somehow harnessed one of the great powers of the world. That's mentioned in a talk I think part Baha'i Cherokee Lee Brown gave a while back, talking about the four races and how the white each has a domain: the reds, the earth; the yellow or gold people, the Asians, the breath, the air; the blacks, water; and the whites, fire. In this sense, electricity. You think of the man-made the sparks that start the cars, the electrical wires, the technology. It has its blessings and its downsides. So I see that as one of the key things is the white, this sort of in quotes white race learning to manage and control the quote fire, the electrical energies that have kind of gotten, Frankensteinish, out of control. So I see that as a key thing for balance with the earth. And then he gives a little summary at the end for each of the sections. I'll just read bits here. Transformation. We cannot opt out of being transformed, but we should understand that there are two kinds of lessons: those that teach how and those that teach how not to be or to do. Simplicity, again, he talks about the simplicity of the bow and arrow. Purpose, whether it's with a job or career, personal guidance, it's a way to feel free and to have a sense of a deeper sense of life, even though you may be doing something not that doesn't seem as purposeful. But if underlying that is a, or undertruthing that is a purpose, then it's all the more real. And strength. And then he talks about the age process, and although some of the elders, their movements were a little stiffer, or their bodies were a little more wrinkled, he writes, "I know now, however, that they were growing stronger in ways that mattered more emotionally and spiritually. Their transformation culminated in the kind of strength they all had in abundance, wisdom. That stature then, to me, was bigger than life and still is." That's a great view. It's such a different view than the ever-polished milieu of the Western media advertising newscast hologram world. And resiliency, I've been shooting the latest bow I made. This one is hickory, 56 inches long and not quite a pound in actual weight, but it probably pulls about 50 pounds at a 22-inch draw. I pull and release, the arrow flashes toward the target, and the limbs return to their original position, ready to send the next arrow. That is resiliency. Again, echo of Asian philosophy's original position. The Tao has a phrase, original wholeness. It's like kind of like a, just returning to that sense of original wholeness and simplicity, sort of like a good night's sleep, but we can do it consciously. Bows and arrows, at least in their atavistic, primitive, and traditional forms, are of no consequence to most people in the world, but they still matter to some of us. They represent life and my journey through it. They will always remind me of the lessons I have learned in life, and they will always remind me of my grandparents. I'm especially blessed because of my grandparents, because of the kind of people they were, and because their lives and their character are examples for us, all the grandchildren who happen to be paying attention. My maternal grandfather was the one who taught me about bows and arrows, how to make them and use them. Bows and arrows brought out his boyish side whenever he shot them, and I can feel his presence each time I walk out to my backyard with bows and arrows in hand. The lessons I take from the bow and arrow are simple. Life is the bow maker, and we are transformed by all the experience we have, all the choices we make or are made for us, and even by those we do not make. There are many values, habits, and characteristics we learn throughout life, but among the most important are simplicity, purpose, strength, and resiliency. It is time for me to string my bow and grab my arrows. And that's the last bit of that book, a wonderful book, Joseph M. Marshall III. It's just so touching. It's refreshing to me to read. I find that, especially with the native writers, just the respect and the depth of connection with the elders and tradition, it really touches me. So I hope you got something out of it too, and I'm sure you did. All right, thank you so much for listening, and keep on keeping on, or as Joseph M. Marshall says, keep going. The Art of Perseverance. And we'll go out with a 3-minute segment. This is Joseph Marshall speaking, and it's a little bit along the lines of one of his other books called Keep Going.
Keep going. A young man asked his Lakota grandfather what the answer was to life's difficulties. Kihela Kayo, said the old man, keep going. And then he said, there are many realities in life, such as joy and sadness, winning and losing, standing and falling, plenty and hunger, and good and bad. But the ultimate reality is that life is a journey, and sometimes we walk it in sunlight, and sometimes in shadow. None of us asked to be born, but we are here, and we must walk our journey with our strengths and our weaknesses. Within each of us is the will to win, as well as the willingness to lose. Or to put it another way, the determination to face life or the fear to turn away from it. Life is not always easy. There are difficulties, storms, if you will, that bring loss, setbacks, sadness, heartache, and disappointments of every kind. But every storm, every difficulty can also teach us to be strong. To learn to be strong, we must stand and face the storms and difficulties that life throws at us. It means crying when we need to, but it also means to keep looking for answers, to keep hoping. It means to survive this moment and the next, until the darkness passes and the sun rises again, as it always will. Life's journey is like climbing a hill. To reach the top, we must do it one step at a time. We should always remember that the smallest or weakest or slowest step toward the sunrise, toward hope, toward the top of the hill, is stronger than any storm or difficulty. And we should never forget that the secret to determination is to keep going, no matter how weary we may be, or no matter what faces us. Above all, we must keep going.